That finishes Norm Broughton on 7 August 78. This is talking with Frank Drake at IRSI in Helsinki on 7 August 78. Now, could you tell me when you first came in contact with radio astronomy?
I first came in contact with radio astronomy when I went to Harvard in the summer of 1955. I had been in the Navy 3 years and had nevertheless been accepted in graduate school. I went to Harvard expecting to study optical astronomy, and when I got there, I discovered I had been assigned to the radio astronomy project.
I see.
On the basis of a background in electronics and having been an electronics officer in the Navy. That turned out to be very good luck. The radio astronomy group at Harvard was a very lively, good one, and this can be attributed entirely to the efforts of Bart Bach, who went to very great effort to create a strong research atmosphere, to provide support, and particularly to get people to interact. The people produced in that era at Harvard have played a major role in radio astronomy in many, many places. They included Bill Howard, Campbell Way, Cochin Menon, May Casson,
Dave Heeshan,
Ed Lilly, Ann Dieter, Bob Davis, and some others. And we were all a very close-knit group, both in research and socially.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, that can be greatly attributed to the work of Bach.
Were you in close contact with the other optical astronomers besides Bach in Harvard?
There was contact, but the contact was not nearly so good because then as now, the senior scientists at Harvard very much isolated themselves from the students, so there was much less contact than one might have hoped.
Mm-hmm. So Bach was an exception to that?
Bach was and still is an exception to that situation. Very important figure in all of that at the time was also Dave Heeshan, who had gone away for a year to Wesleyan and come back, and was instrumental in giving good guidance to the group, but also in working with Bach to get the money to build a 60-foot antenna, a project which commenced just about then. Now, that money came primarily from a normally anonymous donor, a member of the Agassiz family, who gave a great deal of money to Harvard Observatory about that time. Bach succeeded in obtaining from her the money for the 60-foot.
Why was it Heeshan that was working with Bach? Was he sort of a senior graduate student? Or
Heeshan had gotten his Ph.D. in 54 along with Ed Lilly. They, in fact, been the first two radio astronomy graduate students at Harvard. They'd both gone away. Ed Lilly had gone to NRL. Dave Heeshan went to Wesleyan. But after a year, Dave Heeshan came back to Harvard and took over the radio astronomy group and gave it a great deal of strength. In fact, that continued until Dave went to NRAO, which was a serious blow to the group because about that same time, Bach also left for Australia.
Right.
The result was the group was taken over by Tommy Gold and Cochin Menon, both of whom had great skills, but not the skills holding the group together in a congenial atmosphere mm-hmm. that had existed previously.
And that was now 57 or something like that?
That was 57 when both Bach and Heeshan left. Now Dave went to NRAO where he was the galvanizing force for at least the next 5 or 6 years.
Right.
Despite the fact that it wasn't until about 1962 that he was formally director. Nevertheless, before that time, most of the guidance and decisions were really made by him, despite the fact that other people were his director and so forth.
He was the senior radio person, certainly. I mean, Otto Struve was the director, but...
That's right. Dave was the senior radio person. And at various times, we had Lloyd Berkner as a director. He, in fact, did a good thing in that he set very high standards of quality with regard to instruments, people, the way things were done, and I give him a plus for that. He got NRAO established on a very firm basis. Later, Otto Struve came. Both through both of these regimes, though, Dave was really the senior radio astronomer mm-hmm. and was the one everybody depended on for the decisions. Struve was pretty much lost. He came almost because he felt it was his duty to astronomy to help out this struggling young observatory. But in fact, because of his very limited background in radio astronomy, he found it very difficult to make decisions and primarily deferred to other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, he must have had somewhat of an enlightened attitude towards this upstart field, though, to be willing to do this at all.
Oh, he realized the field was quite important. Had a tremendous potential for playing a key role in astronomy. He was excited by the results that were obtained. But he felt very uncomfortable when discussing the techniques mm-hmm. and the terminology, things like flux density and various frequencies were things that were just not comfortable to him. I remember very early after the construction of the first 85-foot telescope, I did a map of the galactic center with very much higher resolution than possible before and showed the Sagittarius A source resolved into a number of components. And Struve looked at that and was very thrilled by it. He said, that one map justifies the entire cost of the telescope.
Let's go back to, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, back to Harvard when you were a graduate student. How was it decided what you would work on?
The decisions as to what people would work on were made by the people themselves. But there was pretty much a roster of possible ideas available, mainly generated by Bach. And this little roster of ideas was the sort of thing that a very traditional astronomer would produce. That is, he would have subjects study the distribution of hydrogen between galactic longitudes 20 degrees and 40 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a subject.
Right.
Now, some of the students actually just adopted such subjects, even though there was no prime scientific question to be addressed. Others they invented their own subjects, which happened to be subjects of interest. For instance, Campbell Wade decided he wanted to study the hydrogen distribution around H2 regions and found a very symmetrical one, Lambda Orionis, and did that one. Nan Dieter decided she wanted to give a try to external galaxies, and so did M33 mm-hmm. as a thesis. In my case, I was very interested in star formation, and I knew that stars were formed in young clusters and OB associations, and so because some other students were working on OB associations, I worked on hydrogen galactic clusters.
I was just wondering, did you get the same education, so to speak, take the same courses as the more traditional astronomy students at Harvard?
Yes, at Harvard, all of the students took the same courses. So mm-hmm. Everyone had same coursework.
Does this mean that the other students were getting two or three radio courses at that time also, even if they were not going to do anything in radio?
At that time, there was only one course in radio. And looking back on it, it was an extremely trivial course. But then that was very early in the history of radio astronomy. But there was just the one course. And otherwise, all the other courses you took were much more traditional.
Mm-hmm.
It was radiative transfer, galactic structure, quantum mechanics.
Celestial mechanics?
There was no celestial mechanics, but there was. When gold came, there was some plasma physics.
Who taught this one course?
Dave Heeshan taught it the year I took it, and after that, Coach Menna taught it. And I think one year Alan Maxwell taught it.
So you did your thesis then on these galactic clusters, H and Chi, Persei, Pleiades, and so forth, the obvious bright big ones. With a 60-foot dish?
Yes, it was done very early after the 60-footer went into operation.
And was that about the 60-footer? Was it did it come into operation very smoothly? There were no troubles with it? Or was this a step that required quite a bit of...
The 60-footer came into operation quite smoothly, but then the standards weren't high. Our receiver was a simple mixer receiver. There was no load noise amplifier. And we had had much experience with that kind of receiver on the old 25-foot antenna.
These were the UN Knight?
These were the UN Knight receivers. With the telescope itself, We were very relaxed about the surface quality. When I look back on it now, I think we were almost unaware that really how accurate a surface must be to produce a certain gain.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was just thrown together and we used it and it seemed to work, but there was no really study done. Similar with the receiver, there was no great effort made to improve the noise temperature, which was about 1,000 degrees at that time. The two things I remember that we considered something new was first the pointing. It turned out did have to be carefully calibrated because we were down to, believe it or not, a 36-minute or 48-minute of arc beam width, which
mm-hmm.
to us was really narrow beam.
Yeah.
And so for the first time, we did a very careful pointing calibration, which I did and I was very proud of.
Using strong radio sources,
and I discovered such things as gravitational deflections and particularly backlash. The fact that the telescope mm-hmm. flopped as it went over the zenith
right.
through zero hour angle is something we'd never even thought about in the old dish.
Did you tie in with the optical by mounting a camera at all or anything like that?
Only the initial alignment of the polar axis mm-hmm. was done that way, but for all the pointing calibrations, we used radio sources.
But I gather that you also weren't using, looking at antenna journals to find out how they calibrated things.
No, we weren't even aware of antenna journals. The other thing that was, in fact, troublesome on that telescope was that we, soon after it was put in operation, we experienced an enormous amount of interference, which developed, was coming from a radio ham who was about a mile away with a beam antenna, which was normally beamed right at our telescope, and he was broadcasting right on the IF
uh-huh.
frequency in the 10-meter band.
Right.
And we had to go to enormous efforts to eliminate that interference because it turned out his signal-to-noise ratio into our IF was about 200 dB, and we had to invent all kinds of filters and grounding straps and shields and so forth.
There was nothing you could require him to do?
No, he was quite legal and he wasn't very cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd like to transmit for many hours each night. He was right.
Yeah, absolute worst sort of situation.
He did aim that antenna right on us. Blast a kilowatt of power into a 10 dB.
So, the 60-foot then got going. What year would this be? 50?
The 60-foot was finished in late 56, but if I remember right. Yeah,
and you began observing these clusters. Now, what did you find out in the clusters?
Well, I found bodies of neutral hydrogen associated with the clusters, and in fact, there was more hydrogen with the younger clusters, such as H and Chi. In retrospect, I'm not sure that all these observations are very sound, because at that time, we were not aware of the very complex cloud structure, the interstellar medium,
mm-hmm.
and at least some of those clouds, which I attributed to the clusters, were in fact fortuitous coincidences with the clusters.
Well, I was going to ask, what was your evidence that it was the cluster?
There are two forms of evidence. One was a discrete cloud whose size and position coincided with the stellar cluster. That's the type of evidence which I now realize is pretty shaky. The other was that in some of those cases, the clusters have very large peculiar velocities. And one did find a cloud
mm-hmm.
that had precisely the peculiar velocity of the cluster. The best case of that is in the Pleiades, where there's a peculiar velocity of about 25 kilometers a second. And it's very near the anti-center, so that the differential galactic rotation does not give large velocity offsets. In that case, there's a cloud that's bang on the Pleiades in velocity and in position.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other clusters, those correlations really weren't so good, and I think the data were overinterpreted.
Well, okay, bringing up the subject of overinterpretation, it seems to me, looking at the work that came out of the Harvard group in the late 50s, that there were some other cases of this bumps and baselines that proved not to be real. What was the basic reason for this overinterpretation being allowed in some sense?
Yeah, there was a great